ولن تبتلى
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتهدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين العبد المعيد الرسول المسدد المصطفى الأمجد المحمود الأحمد سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وأعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الذين قالوا ربنا الله ثم استقاموا تتنزل عليهم الملائكة ألا تخافوا ولا تحزنوا وأبشروا بالجنة التي كنتم توعدون صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد before I begin, if I can just ask for one zahmat, if all of you can please move a little bit away from that door and perhaps shift towards my left, if you don't mind. There's lots of space over here to my left. Let's do this now as opposed to between the majlis, please. One loud salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Imam Hussein, the embodiment of resistance, has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 6. As we do every single night, a quick recap for those of you who are joining us for the first time. First of all, where have you been for 6 days? We have been trying to establish a very simple equation in the deen of Islam, that resistance is victory. And we try to understand the concept of maqawimat in Islam, of resistance in Islam, by first establishing the Quranic approach, the approach of the Ahlul Bayt, the idea that treading a path that is less traveled sometimes is a road to victory, as opposed to treading a path that the majority travel on. And we talked about the fact that Imam Hussein existed in such a climate politically where he was suggested by many individuals who, of course, held his respect. To do what? To not go to Kufa. Don't stand up against Yazid. Leave the Khilafat issue alone. Stay in Medina with your family, with your few Shias. Do your Hujjat. Do some Durus. Lead the people in Medina. Don't give Bayat, that's fine, but don't at the same time go to Kufa. And he resisted all of those different suggestions to actually move towards Kufa with a very small handful of people. And he's been victorious now since that moment that he decided up until right now. We talked yesterday about the idea of separating a war and a battle, and to identify that daily wars happen every single day. The battle is an ongoing battle until we leave this world. When we identify that the battle is the battle against our own desires and that of Shaitan outside of us, then to resist those desires is, of course, our victory in this battle. Now, we have opened up the topic and talked a little bit about our development of that resistance. How can we become individuals who resist the urge to go down a path that's easy, that everyone goes along? And when we reach the middle portion of the Ashra, meaning Saturday, Sunday, and now today, we looked at three, or two at least up until now, very important concepts to now begin to scratch the surface now to inject ourselves with resistance. We talked about emotional intelligence two nights ago. We talked about impulse control yesterday. The idea of choosing a path of deferred gratification, ignoring a path of instant gratification. And we talked about these being ingredients of resistance. And knowing when to fly, knowing when to fight, knowing when to freeze as sons. And that all comes from a package that includes both the emotional and this shahwa, this desire, that lobe I referred to yesterday in the brain that says, I want, I want, I want, that has to be controlled. Okay? Now today will be the last discussion in this subtopic of what we need to build resistance inside of us. Tomorrow being Tuesday, and then Wednesday, of course, we'll look at two factors that block this progress of resistance. Why aren't some of us individuals who can resist this urge inside of us? Why are we easily swayed by the masses? Even though we know it's wrong, we can't fight the urge to go along with that path. We'll look at that tomorrow and Wednesday. Two different qualities that block us from the progress of resistance. But today's discussion. If two nights ago we talked about emotional intelligence and last time we talked about impulse control, today we'll look at the idea of preserving our Islamic identity. Without this identity, we have no idea what we're resisting. And there are major problems and there are major organizations out there that are doing their best to strip our kids and all of you, by extension, of your identity. To confuse you of your deen. To convince you and preach to you that, look, you're not in Pakistan. You're not in Iran. You're not in Iraq. You're not in Afghanistan. You're in the West. This is a non-Islamic country. So leave all those religious rituals there and become somebody who is secular and Western here. That's your victory. That's your salvation here. And in this very infamous discussion of assimilation versus integration, a lot of our generation, a lot of our youth, a lot of our elders got lost in the shuffle. Because when you pick up sociology, you'll know that when you live in a society, you have four different avenues to take. The first avenue is to assimilate. And we'll define each term very briefly, of course. Yesterday I had the gall to teach you about neurology. Today I have even more himma to teach you about sociology. That's how much ego I have inside of me. Either you are to assimilate, or you are to integrate, or you are to marginalize, or you are to separate. Now there are factors within each one, and those of you who are majors in sociology, I'm sure that you'll identify even more of those classifications. But these four are the ones that are very, very important. Let's identify them very, very quickly. Let's see which one Islam is promoting in a non-Islamic society. Present the problem like we usually do. And then, of course, go through the solution. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, the idea of assimilation, and we're talking about a group of people that have now migrated from their country to here. And our communities are more or less comprised of the majority of them, of immigrant families. Since I'm here, let me make this one point in brackets. For those of my youth and I of my generation who were born here to immigrant parents, it's an important point to make, and one that I think sometimes gets lost. I don't think we as kids, and I am a son to immigrant parents, born here in Toronto. Northrock Hospital, Leslie and Shepherd, fourth floor, 407. If you have time, go do my ziyarats and see, oh, this is where Sir Jaffer was born. If you have time only, that's okay. And sometimes what ends up happening is that we kind of lose, and I'm talking about us kids, we lose the sense of understanding how difficult it was for our parents to do what they did. And we lose the appreciation for it. When you hear things like, you know, kids calling their parents backwards and fobs and immigrants and they don't get it. You know, making fun of their own parents' English, for example. And all these things tell us that they have no respect for the fact that their parents left the comforts of their country and the comforts of their family. And that, you know, part of that world that they knew inside and out, to come to this country and learn a language and learn a culture and work any job possible, sometimes 7 days a week, sometimes night shifts, sometimes two jobs at a time, with a flea market stall on the weekends, all to do what? Just to pay the mortgage. And they left that country either because they want a better future for their kids, which was the majority of them, if you ask me, or nowadays because their lives are at danger, let's say, in their country. But just as, you know, Heather Bai just mentioned this glorious picture of Canada, you enter here as a refugee, and now you start from zero. It's very difficult. It's not easy. And you and I, as kids to immigrant parents, if we were asked, let's say, to uproot ourselves and fly to where? The example I give is what? Mongolia. Let's say we're migrating in Mongolia. Okay? You guys know where Mongolia is? Right, yeah. Okay. Mongolia. Uproot your family and go to Mongolia. Raise your kids in Mongolia. Learn Mongolian language. Eat Mongolian food. Walk the streets of Mongolia. And live there not for 5 years or 10 years, but that's where now we're going to set up shop. All not for me. I was good where I was. I was in Pakistan. I was in India. I was in Africa. Those were my streets. I knew every gully out there. I knew the neighbors. I knew the neighbor's neighbor. Everybody. The entire neighborhood raised us. We were all one big family. I loved my school. I loved my teacher. I loved my principal. We'd play crickets in the streets of Karachi. It was fantastic. Now I come here in this winter, mind you. All for what? All for my child. The least we could do as the children of these amazing parents is appreciate that. Is respect them for it. To respect them for something that we would never be able to do. We can't get up and move to Yellowknife, Canada. Same country, same language, same culture. We won't move, let's say, to a city in the same country. Because nowhere's like Toronto, for example. You know, the community is great here. There's amazing halal food. There's good-looking speakers here. There's so many things here. Why would you leave? And yet I see and I find this complete disrespect, not only of the fact of these small things like language and culture, but of their understanding. All of you will come to a realization sooner or later. Those of you who are in your late 20s or your mid-20s or your late teens, you'll sooner or later realize that in your search for someone to guide you and consult with and give you good advice, sooner or later you'll find out that this person doesn't want what's best for me. My parents wants what's best for me. And the person who ends up giving me the best advice of all is my father, is my mother. To sit down and actually ask him, you know, what major do I take in school? You'd be surprised. For the longest time, I never thought my father, marhum, was anybody who was capable of seeking advice from. I didn't think so. No disrespect. I just thought, okay, he doesn't get the culture. Until one day I asked him. I sat down. I said, Dad, what do I do in school? And he blew me away. He gave me advice that up until today, I still follow. So when we talk about immigrant parents, my salams to every single one of you. what you've done and how you've done it. Forget building homes in your own individual lives. You built these four walls for us. You went from basement to basement, rent to rent, bowling alley to bowling alley, unit to unit, and you scrapped coins, you rolled up quarters, you gave dollars, you gave toonie drives, you sold this, you sold that, all to have these beautiful buildings. Not for you, but for us. So let me say this in brackets, end bracket now. Please, learn us as a generation of children who have immigrant parents. Learn to respect your parents. Learn to appreciate your parents. Learn to accept the fact that they did and continue to do today what you and I don't have the strength to do. I'm sorry. And they resisted. There it is again. They resisted the urge to stay in their comfort zone, uproot themselves, and set up shop all over again at the age of 50 sometimes in a brand new country. For their tawfiq, for their longevity. One salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, please. Back to our class on sociology. To assimilate, to integrate, to marginalize, to separate. Okay? And we all know pretty much what each one means. To assimilate is basically to enter into a new country and to become such a part of that community and that country where now you've lost your culture altogether. Okay? The food you eat changes, your language changes, your name even changes. That's assimilation. Very quickly, very brief definition. I don't have time. To integrate is a two-way process. The host culture and the culture that you own now come together, and they both give in a little bit to be able to coexist together. We respect you as the host culture. You respect us as now the visiting culture. We understand that you have values that you want to implement. You have to understand there are rules and laws in our host country that you have to respect. It's a two-way process. That's called what? Integration. To marginalize is to avoid the host culture and to lose your own culture. You become somebody who has no identity whatsoever. And then to separate is to come to a host country, ignore and deny and fight and revolt against the very culture that you've migrated to, all in an effort to cling on to your culture. Okay, these are the four of them, very quickly. Islam says if you can achieve a balance in any one of these four, do your best to integrate. We don't support assimilation. We don't support the idea to marginalize. We definitely don't support the idea to separate. Now we see communities, families, cluster of families enter each one of these four categories. I'm sure all of you as well. We've seen families assimilate so much that you have no idea where their Pakistani began and where their Canadian ends. I'm picking on Pakistan because my parents are from Pakistan, don't worry. We see families that separate so much that they enjoy the passport of Canada in one hand, all the benefits, all the OSAP, all the checks in the mail, but they burn the flag in the other. Islam also denies that as well. And we've seen families that do their best of this balancing act. And my youth, you guys are in that fight right now. How much of this society do I assimilate or do I accept? How much do I hold on to in terms of my identity? It's a constant battle. And some of you guys have it figured out, mashallah, and some of us don't. And unless we're able to hold on to our identity, we won't resist the notion to give up our identity and now tread the path of assimilation. And without identity, we're nobody. We are known as our identity. And the Quran talks about this and gives a very beautiful example. Let me present those examples and then move on. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. One day, someday, I'll talk with all of you about the power of dua the etiquette of dua. And I'm sure that that topic has been discussed several times here. We have a couple of very beautiful stories in the lives of the prophets and from the Quran as well. Nabi Musa alayhi salam was leading the Bani Israel away from the clutches of Fir'aun into salvation. And as he was trying to part his way out and lead this tribe, sorry, I'm being asked to kind of, if you can all please move a little bit forward as you recite salawat. There's patches I can see on my left and right. Please come as tight as possible. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, please. Sorry, we'll get Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So Nabi Musa is leading this tribe of the Bani Israel away from Fir'aun, and they get lost in the way. Follow me, please. These are three examples back to back that are linked very beautifully together. And the story goes on to say that while they're trying to find their way back, let's say to the sea or out of Fir'aun's clutches, they consult with each other, some of the heads of the tribe, and of course Nabi Musa. What do we do in this predicament? An elderly gentleman from the Bani Israel tribe says to Nabi Musa that I heard from my ajdad, from my forefathers, that Nabi Yusuf had told the Bani Israel tribe that when you leave from here, take my grave and my coffin with you. Wherever you go, bury me there. I don't want to be buried here. And we haven't done that. And so now Nabi Musa announces to the tribe that does anybody in this tribe know where Nabi Yusuf is buried? There's quiet, there's silence. A very old, frail woman makes her way to the front and says, I know where Nabi Yusuf is buried. And Nabi Musa says, can you disclose that location for me? She says, I can, but I want something in return. Before I tell you that, let me quote to a story during Prophet of Allah's time, very quickly. Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa
ali Muhammad.
As many of you know, he lived in Mecca. At the age of 40, he announced his prophethood. Before 40, of course, he was part of society. There was an individual who would assist the Holy Prophet before the announcement of his prophethood, either sometimes giving him some shelter or sometimes helping him out with various other things. He was instrumental in assisting the Prophet before the announcement of his prophethood. When the Prophet of Allah announced his prophethood, and within 7, 8, 9 years now, this momentum of Islam was growing. This kingdom of Islam now had become very rich and valuable. The friend of that individual who used to help the Prophet approached him. Says, do you recognize this man who's claiming to be the Prophet of Allah? He says, of course I recognize him. It's Muhammad bin Amin, of course I do. He says, do you remember what you used to do for him before he became the Prophet? He says, yes, I do. He says, do you know how much this individual is worth and how much his mission is worth? If I were you, I'd go and remind him who you are and what you did for him. He says, okay. He goes to the Prophet of Allah, he says, do you remember, recognize me? Of course I recognize you. You assisted me at sometimes the best times. I'll never forget what you've done for me. He said, you've become the Prophet of God. He says, yes, I have. is I just want to remind you again of everything that I've done for you. Looking for payback, of course. The prophet's very smart. He says, no problem, what would you like? He gives a long list of things. X amount of dinars, X amount of camels, X amount of this. Some land, maybe. The prophet says, no problem. He gives it to this individual and he leaves. One companion asked the prophet of Allah, what was this all about? He says, well, you know, this is who this person was. He wanted this from me. I gave it to him, no problem. And then the prophet says a sentence. He said, if only this man asked from me what the old woman asked from Nabi Musa. It's a very famous story. Let's go back to Nabi Musa's time. Old woman says, I want something. I can tell you where he is, but I want my price. Nabi Musa says, what's your price? She says, well, I'm old. I want you to give me my youth back. Listen very carefully. It gets better. He says, okay. She says, I have trouble walking with my legs. I want new legs as well. Okay, no problem. And then she says, on the day of judgment, I want to be raised with you, Nabi Musa. Look, your legs and youth, we can do that. I don't know about being raised with the prophet. But Nabi Musa says, no problem. Your dua is granted. Location of the grave is found. And of course, they make their way out of the clutches of Fir'aun. You have one level of an individual who asks for what? Material things, right? Some land, some camels, some dollars that, you know, he'll probably waste in a matter of years. Next level up, she also asked for her youth back, her legs back, but she wanted her akhirah to be beside Nabi Musa, no problem. Come to the third level. In Surah Tahrim, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses an example of a woman. When he says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَضَرَبَ اللَّهُ مَثَلًا لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَمْرَأَتَ فِرْعَوْنَ إِذْ قَالَتْ يَا رَبِّي إِبْنِي لِي عِنْدَكَ بَيْتًا فِي الْجَنَّةِ وَالنَّجْرِ مِنْ فِرْعَوْنَ وَعَمِلِهِ وَالنَّجْرِ مِنْ الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ Oh, what a beautiful story this is. We hear the wife of Fir'aun and we think, oh, this is for those guys on that side. It's not. Listen very carefully. The Quran says that we now are using an example for who? لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا Not for everybody, for those who are the Ahli Iman. For all of you, mashallah. What is that example? Amra'ata Fir'aun, the wife of Fir'aun. When she said what? Ya Allah, build for me. Listen very carefully. Keep the levels in mind. You go from camels and horses and dinars to being raised with Nabi Musa in the Day of Judgment to what Bibi Asiya was asking for from Allah. She says what? Build for me. عِنْدَكَ بَيْتًا فِي الْجَنَّةِ Build for me. Not a house in Jannat. Not any house in Jannat. I want a house that's عِنْدَكَ. That's beside you, Allah. Wait a second now. It's one thing where you want to be raised with Nabi Musa. It's one thing where you want a house in Jannah. It's one thing where you want Allah to be your neighbor in Jannah. If I'm 71 Jannah way, God 73 Jannah way. He's my neighbor. That's what I want. Indaka, close to you. Beside you, close to you. And the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses this example in the Quran not only tells us that he granted that dua to her, says that she had all the right to ask for that dua. Why? Oh, why? Because she had the ability to live, not in a Fir'aunic society, to live beside Fir'aun, and resist the urge to become Fir'aun-like. And when you resist the urge to become Fir'aun-like and fight that urge and fight that urge, this wasn't her leader. This wasn't some man of a kingdom. This was the woman's husband. Usually, you know, usually the wife supports the husband. Even if it's wrong, she'll support him. Stand right beside him. But this was Bibi Asiya. And what she did in the process was she hung on to her identity and her iman. And didn't let go of that. And for that reason, Allah uses this dua as an example. لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا For those who have iman. She goes on to say, I want the house in Jannat. Oh, by the way, free me from Fir'aun and what he does. And also free me from those who are unjust. You would think, wow, badi himmat hai bhai, she's asking for these big du'as. That himmat is there, why? Because she was able to show Allah, Allah, you put me beside Fir'aun. And you would think for a moment that I would be affected. I didn't. Instead, I took your prophet, I raised him, I gave him tarbiyat, I elevated him, and then I let him go. And that same prophet turned around and destroyed the Fir'aun of his time. What an example. Is there a better example than this for us, for resistance and for identity? There isn't. It doesn't mean that on the way home today you say, see, I'm not that bad, at least I'm not Fir'aun. That's not my point, please. Nor do you tell your wife that, look, you begin to be Asiya, I'll stop being Fir'aun. That's also not my purpose. The purpose was that when you start to resist, why do I bring this example up? Because people like me and my generation, we have this incredible ability, mashallah, to create excuses for ourselves. We are masters at that. We can teach neurology, we can teach sociology, and we can teach excuse making. And part of the excuse, Sayyid, I would love to be everything that you say on the minbar, but we live in the West, man. Come on now. This is a very dangerous society. It's not Islamic. So if I was in Iran or Pakistan where the Adhan goes off, where I have, let's say, Friday off, the day of Ashura off, Dwight Tawassul is on television, Dwight Kamil is on Channel 3, let's say, for example, I would be flying high in the ladder of spirituality. But I'm not. I live in Brampton. I live in Markham. I live in Richmond Hill. I barely pray Salat. What do you want from me? So all these excuses now go out the door because you live in a Fir'aunic society. This is a woman who lived beside Fir'aun himself. If she can resist the urge, then you and I can as well. And then we have the ability to now ask Allah for the impossible. Because you would think, okay, a house in Jannah is one thing. Beside Allah, that's a little bit of greediness. But Allah says, no, I'm using this example for a reason. Prophet of Allah, and during that time, he asked for one thing. Nabi Musa's request, and then of course the Quranic approach to the Tahrim, ayat number 11, that talks about Bibi Asiya. My brothers and my sisters, we talk about this idea of resistance and identity for a reason. We are in an uphill battle here in the West. We're fighting this major fight, and the fight is to understand who are we. When you ask yourself, who am I? And you get to the point that this is who I am. That this is who I am has to be accompanied with pride and strength. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam. He says, if you enter the deen of Islam, for the people, you will exit the deen of Islam for the people. If you enter the deen of Islam for the Quran and the Sunnah of the Ahlul Bayt, mountains will move, he says. You will not leave the deen at all. And this goes to a very famous discussion we've had several times about biological Muslims and haqiqi Muslims, and this idea of having this very important transition from the fact that, you know, what is my last name to what is my iman? Because nobody in the grave will ask you what is your dad's name. Everyone will ask you, what did you do in this world? We have a very nice tradition by our Holy Prophet Muhammad Mustafa sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He says that on the Day of Judgment, the servants of Allah will be very comfortable in this journey on the Day of Judgment. Where others, like myself, every station will be a difficult one, he says the true servants of Allah will fly through it. He said that they won't, their qadam, their feet won't shake until they're asked a few questions. And this hadith is enough for us to ponder on what's going on. He says the first question that you will be asked that will make even my slaves shake at their feet is, what did you do in this world? What did you do with your youth? How did you spend your money? And what did you do with the love of the Ahlul Bayt? Because the reality of the picture is this, that we are now moving towards a movement right now where they are trying to reintroduce your own deen to you as a different package. Let me explain this a little bit in detail. Please follow me. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. If we look at the face of Islam today, what those outside this building understand Islam to be, you'll understand what I'm talking about. That there is this package or this path of Islam in Nab, it's called, the pure Islam. Islam in Muhammadi, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And the Islam of the West. And when I say the West, I don't refer to certain countries. The West used to be a geographical reference. Now it's an ideology that you could find in the streets of India and Pakistan. You could find, let's say, here. It's a secular approach. And this secular Islam that's being introduced to our kids at the tender age of 14, 15, when they're still kind of confused of what's happening, has two very important components. One is the fact that they're trying to separate church and state, that keep the Muslims in the masjid, keep them praying, keep them fasting, keep them giving charity, keep them from, that's fine, you know, they don't lie, they don't give, they don't backbite, they give charity, sadaqah, zakat, they go for hajj, you know, they come back, that's fine, keep them in the masjid. What we don't want is for them and their ideology to trickle into the schools, to trickle into the workplace, and to trickle onto the streets. Because they could influence people that we don't want influenced. So they will put together procedures and laws and curriculums that do what? Stop the flow of your deen and keep it within your home and within your masjid. And you're good there. Don't spill out on the streets. Don't come out and bring your sharia and your deen to the workplace. Don't tell me that, oh, you know what, I can't shake your hand. Don't tell me I can't attend this event because it's at a tavern. Don't tell me that this and this and this, this is the workplace. There's no room here for the deen. And some of us have actually bought into that. And that's this Islam, where they're trying to separate church and state. Whereas the deen of Islam says that Islam is everything and everywhere. Islam is not a series of practices. Islam is a way of life. You heard it 1,000 times. When the Holy Prophet is telling Abu Dharr, everything that you do, attach a niyat to it. You sleep, have a niyat behind it. You wake up, have a niyat behind it. You eat, you talk, you walk, you put on your clothes. Everything should have a niyat behind it. Why? It becomes an ibadat then. And now you create worship when really on the outside, there's no worship there whatsoever. Putting on your jeans isn't worship. But putting on your jeans, let's say for Allah, it becomes worship. This version of Islam doesn't want that. Now a lot of you will not agree, and that's okay. We've established that there won't be always agreement between all of you and me, and that's fine. The second component of this different version of Islam is that they want to make this Islam very, very exclusive. And the deen of Islam came to be inclusive of everybody. So now all of a sudden, this slogan that you have, this beautiful statement of La ilaha illallah, which is a beautiful statement. And this beautiful slogan of Allahu Akbar now has been so tainted where even you and I now, when we hear a chant of takbir on the news, we're expecting violence to follow that takbir. And then this philosophy that either you are with us or we behead you. Where in our deen has that ever been a philosophy? To counter that, let's come to the life of our fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful tradition. They say one day, our fifth imam, and these riwayat, these traditions might sound a little bit ajeeb to all of you, especially my elders. They say that he was making bread one day with his own hands. He would plant the seeds of wheat, he would grow the wheat, he would convert that wheat into flour, and with that same flour, he would of course bake bread. And the companions would wonder, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, with all due respect, I mean, shouldn't you be in the masjid reading du'as or salat? You're here baking bread. Many times in the life of our fifth imam, many times you would find him doing something, for example, gardening, for example, or working, or you know, digging up, let's say, or plantation. And the companions would come very, very confused. Is this part of the deen? He would say, absolutely. He goes, if in this state of me planting something in the ground and I die in this state, I die a shaheed, he says. To paint a picture that what Islam is all encompassing, Islam can be found even in gardening. He's baking the bread. Now those of you who have been to Mashhad, mashallah, may Allah accept your ziyarat, there they have a dastakhan of Imam Radha, where for non-Iranians they give you a lunch ticket and you are given a very beautiful, tasty meal at lunchtime. You go, you get the ticket, mashallah, and this beautiful food comes and you guys eat until you are full. And then of course, what people like to do is to bring the bread or the naan home with them. They break small pieces for barakat, that while you are cooking your own meal at home now, have a little bit of Imam Raza's naan for barakat. This is what? This is the bread that was baked in the haram of Imam Raza. This is bread that was baked by the hands of Imam Baqir. There's barakat. He says to the companions that I will take this bread and I'll go to non-Muslim areas and deliver this bread to them with the hopes that maybe the barakat of this bread will help them accept the path of Islam. Look at the Daesh approach of deen. Look at the fifth imam's approach of the deen. Look at the exclusive nature of either you're with us or we behead you, and the inclusive nature that come and join our path. And here's some bread with full of barakat for you as well. Have we lost this path? I don't know. Is this path being shoved down our throat? Absolutely. And if we don't know how to handle that in our workforce, in our schools, even amongst our own circles, we'll start to accept this Western secular Islam. And we have to be very careful. The Maraji have constantly talked about in the West, reviving Islam in Nab, reviving the pure Islam, going back to the fundamental policies and procedures. Right now, there are attacks being done within the circles of Islam on some of the major and most fundamental principles of the deen. Marjiyat attacked, Khums attacked, Azadari attacked. All these things are being attacked. Why? Because they're trying to remove Islam and Muhammadi and elevate the secular Islam in front of us. In the process, strip us of our identity. We have to have our eyes open. These eyes and these eyes. Our eyesight and our insight. And understand what's happening around the world. And mashallah, many of you are fully aware. My discussions with all of you, my talks, the questions, the workshop we had with the youth on Saturday, it blew me away how aware our youth are. But our job is to remind and to ensure that you don't lose this identity of yours. With identity comes power. With power comes resistance. Now when someone comes and tries to sway you off the path, you're not going anywhere. This is who I am, is your slogan. And that slogan comes with pride, with strength, and with courage, and with resistance. Otherwise, you've seen people, I've seen people. They start off great, very muttaqi, very pious. Something happens in their life. They meet somebody, they get a job, they get a raise. And that path slowly is gone, and they begin to enter this path of secularism, this Western Islam. And slowly but surely, they start to fade away from the picture. It's a very dangerous discussion. It's a reality out there. Reviving the principles of the deen is part of our responsibility. And that's part of the identity building process. And when you can do that, you can start to tread the path of resistance. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. When we examine the fitrat of a mother, we see some amazing qualities in that mother. This is a woman who would sacrifice every ounce of comfort that she had, would sacrifice any urge she had, if it meant that her child is safe. She would take on every bala, every struggle, every hardship, every stress a child has, and take all of it on if it meant that my child could sleep stress-free at night. She has no concern for herself, and every concern is her child. On the musalla, her du'as aren't for her, it's for her child. The child could be miles away from her. All she keeps on saying to Allah and to that child, Ke jaan bhi raho, khush raho, wherever you are, be happy. Just be happy. A mother who, when you say salamu alaykum a certain way, just a salam, she can identify that something is wrong. A mother that when you leave in the morning and she sees you off, you can hear du'as being recited on her lips. And the du'as don't stop until you come back home safely. A mother who when you enter the house at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're as quiet as can be, thinking the whole house is sleeping, she's wide awake. Because she won't sleep until you are safe and secure in your bed. When our fourth imam describes the haqq of the mother in his Risalat al-Huquq, he says, you should understand that your mother went hungry so you could eat. She went thirsty so you could drink. She went sleepless so you could sleep. And then he says that she stood in the blazing sun so you could lay in the cool shade. That's the fitrat of the mother. To stand in front of the child as a shield and take on everything this dunya has to throw at that child. But when you come to the mothers of Karbala, that fitrat is something else. When you examine those mothers who brought their children to Karbala, we see that their fitrat has been replaced, has been removed. And the only concern that these mothers have is that of Hussein. We drown ourselves in the ocean of Hussein as if he has drowned himself in the ocean of Allah. Now no longer is the mother worried about protecting their child. Now her concern is make sure that we sacrifice our children before Hussein sacrifices his. Where we have the fitrat of the mother there to protect the child even from one scar, one bruise, one cut, we have Bibi Zainab in the khaymah talking to Ono Muhammad and saying, look, I will wait by the door of the khaymah and see which one of you is more brave in your battle. All the fitrat is gone. Hussein is left. She's preparing them. As the shayar says, Bibi Zainab says that even if you get to the banks of Furat, I know you're thirsty, but don't think of your own thirst. Sakina is thirsty, Ali Askar is thirsty, your mama Hussein is thirsty. This is the mother of these two children. She prepares them for battle, puts on the armor, and she says, go and ask your uncle Hussein for permission. Honor Muhammad arrived in front of Imam Hussein. Can you imagine now? Some reports say there were 7 and 9. Some say there were 10 and 12. Small children. How many of you in this house have 8, 9-year-olds? Imagine now your 2 nephews coming to you, dressed in armor, asking you, Mamu, please, can we have ijazat to go sacrifice our life for your mission? What could Imam Hussein possibly say? He says the one thing he could say, I can't give you permission until your mother gives you permission. And then they say that, Mamu John, it was Mama herself that sent us here to get your permission. Sacrifice everything for Hussein, for he sacrificed everything for Allah. Our salams to you, the mothers of Karbala. You have denied your fitrah for that of Hussein. Imam Hussein, they say, hugs both of his nephews. They cry for a very long time. He puts on green imamas on both of them, mounts them on a horse, and watches them as they battle. They were small. I have no idea how they picked up the sword. I have no idea how the armor fit. I have no idea how they beat the enemies. But they killed the kuffar. They killed the kuffar until finally they fell from the horse. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Abul Fazl, Abbas, and Hussein run to the Maidan. Grab Ono Muhammad. Come back to the Khaymah. Now everybody is waiting to see the reaction of the mother of Ono Muhammad. Lying on the sands of Karbala are 2 lifeless bodies. The door of the Khaymah opens. Bibi Zainab comes walking out very slowly. She kneels down. She puts one head on the chest of Aun. She puts one head on the chest of Muhammad. Falls into sajda. Ya Allah, accept this small hadiah. She takes this grief with her from Karbala to Kufa, Kufa to Sham, back to Karbala. She enters Medina, gets to the house, opens the door, sees Abdullah. Abdullah, come and give me poison for Allah. Matam Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.